"What story?" Stone asked. "Read the paper." Rawls hung up. Stone found his copy and read the story. Oh, this was good. Marker must have choked on his breakfast when he saw this. He called Paul Carlson.
"Good morning, Stone."
"Good morning, Paul. Have you read the Wall Street Journal this morning?"
"I have.
I assume you planted the story."
"I wish I'd thought of it, but I didn't."
"Then who did?" "An acquaintance of an acquaintance of mine."
"I take it you don't want to tell me who."
"It's not someone you know, in any case. Suffice it to say, he has at least one friend at St. Clair Enterprises."
"Do you know him?"
"No, it's all third party."
"I must admit, Stone, I'm anxious about the counteroffer."
"We should have some idea of how we're doing when FedEx delivers tomorrow morning," Stone replied.
"I'll try and be patient," Paul said.
"So will I." They said goodbye and hung up. 16. Stone was at his desk the following morning when Joan buzzed. The elder male Dr. Carlson on one. He pressed the button.
"Yes, Paul." "Good morning, Stone."
"Good morning.
FedEx delivered half an hour ago, and about half the stockholders have accepted. Their checks are being written as we speak. We now own 53% of the clinic, and of course there could be more tomorrow."
"Congratulations, Paul."
"Thank you. May we now dispense with the armed guards?"
"No, you may not. This may set Marker off. Let's look at it again in a week."
"Thank you again, Stone."
"You are entirely welcome."
"I promise you the family will never again own less than 50% of the stock."
"I'm delighted to hear it. Paul, I'd like to invite you and your tribe and their wives or girlfriends to dinner one night soon. Would Friday evening be convenient for all of you?"
"I'll take a vote and call you back."
"Good." They hung up. 20 minutes later, Paul called back.
"This Friday is good for all of us. The boys will bring their wives."
"Will you bring a lady?" Stone asked.
"Well, one of Marissa's security guards is very attractive.
Shall I ask her?"
"Please do.
7 o'clock for drinks."
"Perfect."
They hung up and Stone called Dino.
"Bichetti."
"Good news. The Carlsons are majority owners of their clinic again."
"Great news."
"They're all coming for dinner on Friday evening. Will you and Viv join us?"
"Sure we will. She'll actually be in town."
"Drinks at 7. They hung up. Stone called Ed Rawls.
"Yeah, it's Stone. Will you by any chance be in New York the day after tomorrow?"
"Give me an excuse."
"The Carlsons are owners of their clinic again, and we're celebrating. Dinner Friday evening?"
"That's a good excuse."
"How's the widow hunting in Islesboro?"
"They are thick on the ground."
"Would you like to bring one?" "I'll put you both up, together or separately."
"Yes, I would.
If we fly from our little airport directly to Teterboro, we could arrive late afternoon."
"Excellent. See you then."
He hung up and buzzed Joan.
"Yes, sir.
Will you let Helene and Fred know that we'll be 12 for dinner at 8 on Friday? Drinks at 7.
"Certainly."
"Ask her to get back to me with a menu."
"Certainly."
On Thursday morning, Eric Macher picked up his Wall Street Journal. There it was, on page 1 again. "Macher at St. Clair loses bid for the Carlson Clinic." He wanted to throw up on his desk. He started to ring for Fox, but he wasn't the go-to guy for where Macher wanted to go. He picked up the phone and dialed an extension in a basement office. The man was standing before him in less than a minute. Jake Herman was ex-FBI, having been asked to leave in the wake of an unnecessarily violent incident some years before. He was smart, in a feral sort of way, and entirely without scruples of any kind. A classic sociopath. He was also inordinately fond of money. Mocker explained what had just happened.
Jake, I want retribution, he said.
I suppose you want them all dead?
Jake asked with a look of distaste.
Not necessarily. In fact, it would be better to avoid killing. The police work too hard at solving murders.
How about if I do something to the clinic?
What did you have in mind?
Maybe some Legionnaire's disease in their air conditioning system,
Jake suggested. Mocker thought about it.
Too likely to kill a patient or two.
Then how about a rumor of Legionnaire's disease in their air conditioning system?
Where could you plant such a rumor?
It would make it more credible if it were in 2 or 3 publications on the same day.
Can you do that?
I know a guy who knows a guy, a failed publicist who writes a gossip blog. If he got it out late this afternoon, it could hit the papers tomorrow morning.
They read all the blogs.
It'll have to be a little on the subtle side. The guy isn't interested in lawsuits.
Do it, Mocker said. For tomorrow's papers.
I'm on it,
Jake replied. He left the room. On Friday morning, Paul Carlson's son, Sven, came into his office with a newspaper.
Look at this, he said, placing the paper on his father's desk. A circle had been drawn around a headline.
At Swank Clinic, Legionnaire's disease?
Paul read on.
An anonymous report has come in that 2, possibly 3 patients at a swanky Upper East Side private hospital with Scandinavian connections have presented with symptoms of an often fatal respiratory illness. Their air conditioning system is suspected, and the New York City Department of Health is descending on the clinic with swarms of inspectors.
Do we have patients with any such symptoms, Sven?
No, sir. I checked, and our air conditioning system was checked and disinfected the day before yesterday, as it is monthly.
Paul buzzed his secretary.
Get me the head of the New York City Department of Health.
A moment later, she came back.
Mr. Swanson on line 1.
Paul picked up the phone.
Mr. Swanson, are you aware of a report in a morning newspaper that a clinic on the Upper East Side may have patients with Legionnaire's disease?
That has just come to my attention, Dr. Carlson.
I believe this to be a malicious rumor aimed at our facility, and I want you to know that we have checked and we have no patients exhibiting symptoms of anything they didn't arrive with, especially not Legionnaire's disease. Also, our air conditioning system was checked and disinfected 2 days ago as part of our monthly inspection routine. If you wish to send inspectors here to confirm this, we will welcome their attention.
Dr. Carlson, I think it would be to the benefit of both of us if I send a team over there this morning. We will give them full cooperation. Tell them to ask for me personally.
He hung up.
Sven, thank you for bringing this to my attention. The health department will deal with this immediately, and I want to issue a press release when they are done.
Sven returned to his office. Paul called Stone Barrington.
Yes, Paul? Stone, I believe we have now heard from Mr. Mocker.
17. Stone's fax machine cranked out a sheet of paper early in the afternoon. It was printed on the letterhead of the Carlson Clinic, and he read it with interest. The Carlson Clinic denies libelous news report. This morning's papers printed a report implying that the Carlson Clinic, one of America's foremost medical institutions, had patients exhibiting signs of an infectious lung disorder that was being spread by its air conditioning system. This report is false and malicious. After a thorough check of each resident patient, it has been determined that not one harbors these symptoms.
The clinic summoned the New York City Department of Health inspectors and asked them to inspect the air conditioning system, and they reported that no trace of a microbe or virus was detected. The Carlson Clinic demands that an abject retraction by these publications appear in Saturday's and Monday's editions in the same front-page space occupied by the false report. The clinic has instructed its attorneys to immediately bring a libel action against any publication that does not meet this demand. It was signed by Paul Carlson. Stone called Dr. Carlson.
Yes, Stone?
I want to compliment you on your deft handling of this Legionnaire's nonsense. I'm confident you will get your retractions.
Thank you, Stone. The part about having instructed our attorneys was a little inaccurate, so I will instruct you now. If these retractions are not satisfactory or are printed anywhere else in the papers than the front page, file an immediate action for libel, slander, and anything else you can think of.
I acknowledge your instructions, Stone replied.
Thank you. We'll all see you at dinner.
Stone found the evening's menu on his desk. Seared foie gras, crown roast of lamb, risotto, haricot vert, and a dessert of creme brulee with fresh Maine blueberries. He approved it, then went to his cellar with Fred and chose the wines. Shortly after 5, Ed Rawls arrived with a handsome woman of about 50 in tow, whom Ed introduced as Emma Harrison, and Stone showed them to the same bedroom, at Ed's request. At the stroke of 7 o'clock, the front doorbell rang, and Fred escorted a gaggle of Carlsons into the living room. The boys' wives, Greta and Inga, were introduced, and Paul introduced his date for the evening, Kara Nielsen. While Stone was welcoming them, the Bichettis arrived, and Ed and Emma emerged from the elevator. Marissa whispered to Stone,
"What do you think of Papa's new girlfriend?"
"Very nice.
She is the first armed woman he has ever taken out. Can you guess where her gun is?"
"No."
"Good."
Fred served cocktails in the living room, as the study would have been cramped with so many people, and piano music wafted over the invisible sound system.
"I like the music," Marissa said after a few minutes. "Who is the pianist?"
"I fear it is I," Stone replied.
"Have no fear. It's lovely. A secret talent?"
"Fairly secret."
He warmed to the praise. Fred came to him after a few minutes.
"There is a phone call for you."
"Who is it?"
"He won't say, but he says it's very urgent."
Stone went into the study and picked up a phone.
"This is Stone Barrington. Get it off your chest."
"Mr. Barrington," a man's gruff voice said, "there is a bomb planted in your house that will detonate in exactly 3 minutes."
There was a click, and Stone could hear the ticking of a stopwatch. Stone thought about it for about 10 seconds and decided it was impossible that anyone could have planted a bomb in his house.
"Please give Mr. Marker a message from me," he said. "Tell him that if anything like that occurs, I will shoot or have him shot before tomorrow passes."
He hung up and returned to his guests.
"Anything wrong?" Marissa asked when he returned.
"Not a thing," Stone said, looking at his watch.
When a little more time had passed, he clinked his signet ring on his glass to get attention.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I would like you to know that I have received an anonymous phone call saying that a bomb would explode in this house in 3 minutes. That was 5 minutes ago, so you need not stop drinking."
There was a deep silence for about 5 seconds. Then everyone put down his drink and applauded.
"Thank you for your confidence," he said, and they continued drinking.
They dined convivially, and after dessert, a port, Quinta de Noval 1960, was served with Stilton and biscuits. When they were back in the living room on coffee and cognac, Dino came and sat down next to Stone.
I could have had the bomb squad here, you know.
In 3 minutes? Just in time to pick up the pieces?
How did you respond to the call?
I told the man to tell Maka that if it went off, I'd shoot or have him shot before tomorrow is out.
That was an extremely stupid thing to do,
Dino said. If I had taken any other step, it would have ruined my dinner party, Stone said. Nobody would have been able to relax.
I had a thought,
Dino said. Did you now?
How about if I call a full-scale bomb alert at the St. Clair Mansion in the middle of the night? You know, break down the door, flood the house with men in bomb suits and sniffer dogs, turn Macher out in his skivvies, like that.
Dino, my friend, that is a charming notion, and one you should hold in reserve in case this thing escalates.
It could very well escalate, you know.
I know, and I expect it to until Maka really tries to hurt somebody. But we've taken all the proper precautions, and if we should decide to execute your excellent plan, I'd like for everybody here to be out of town when it happens.
Just let me know when,
Dino replied. 18. Eric Macher had just boarded what was now, effectively, his yacht, when his cell phone rang.
Macher, he said into it, this better be good.
It's Jake, the caller said, and it's not good.
Macher listened as Jake played the recording of his telephone conversation with Stone Barrington the evening before.
Shit,
he screamed, alarming the two crew who were bringing his luggage aboard.
This is what happens when we make empty threats, Jake said.
Are you saying that we're going to have to up our offer by 75%?
It's too late for that, Jake said. I'm informed that as of this morning, the Carlsons have accumulated about 65% of the stock in the clinic, and they'll probably get more. And your secretary said to tell you that the board of directors has requested a meeting Monday morning at 9 a.m.,
Macher sat down and began taking deep breaths, trying to get his pulse and his blood pressure down.
Eric, are you all right?
Not exactly, Macher said.
Tell me what you want to do.
Take out one of the Carlsons, he said.
Which one?
I don't care. Just make it look accidental.
Eric, they've got strategic services protection, every one of them. And I don't have to tell you how good that outfit is. Now, I can probably get a shot at one of them, but the police will be all over us. Make that all over you.
All right. What do you suggest?
I suggest we lie low for a few days, wait for them to pull their guards off, then reassess. Or maybe a more serious shot across their bows.
That's good advice, Jake.
Do the second one. Have my secretary call the board members and tell them I'm out of town, and I'll meet with them Wednesday morning at 10.
Got it,
Jake replied, then hung up. One of the crewmen was standing by, looking concerned.
Bring me a drink, Macher said.
Certainly, sir. What would you like?
A great big single malt scotch.
Right away, sir.
The man was back in a flash with a double old-fashioned glass filled with scotch on a silver tray and an ice bucket.
Would you like ice, sir?
No.
The man extended the tray.
There you are, sir. Would you like me to tell the captain he can get underway?
Macher grabbed the glass and took a big swig.
Do it.
Yes, sir. And the chef would like to know what time you'd like lunch served.
1 o'clock sharp.
We'll be four.
The chopper is gone for the others.
Yes, sir.
The man dematerialized.
Macher took one more gulp of the scotch.
He tossed the rest overboard and set down the glass. He couldn't be drunk when his guests arrived.
For one thing, he wanted to get laid this afternoon, and he couldn't manage that with a load on. Jake was having a sandwich for lunch when his phone rang.
"Please God," he said, "not Mocker."
It was not. It was one of his platoon of ex-FBI men.
"Yeah?" "Jake, I'm with Barrington and the Carlson woman. You'll never guess where they are."
"Tell me."
"They've just finished lunch at the Central Park boathouse and they're getting into a rowboat."
Jake brightened.
"What's the opposition like?" "As far as I can tell, there isn't any, but I think Barrington is packing."
"Where are you exactly?"
"At a table in the boathouse. Zelda is with me."
"I'll be there shortly. Don't lose sight of the boat." He hung up, rang for a car, got a briefcase from his coat closet, and beat it out of the house. Stone rode slowly and reluctantly.
"I feel like an idiot," he said to Marissa. "I haven't done this since I was in college."
"Actually, I would never have known that. You seem quite good at it."
"It's like roller skating. I haven't forgotten how, but I'd like to."
She looked at him appraisingly.
"Have you ever made love in a rowboat?"
"Maybe, but not one in Central Park on a Saturday afternoon."
"There are some bushes over there,"
she said playfully, pointing.
"Oh, no, you don't," Stone said, steering away from the bushes.
"Oh, come on."
"I am unaccustomed to self-induced discomfort," Stone said. "That's why I gave up camping."
"What do you have against camping?" she asked.
"I don't like sleeping on the hard ground in a tent, and mosquitoes carry disease."
"You don't like the outdoors?"
"Not for some things. Think of me as a great indoorsman."
Jake arrived at the boathouse and found his two operatives there, lingering over coffee.
"Where's the boat?"
he asked.
2 o'clock and 100 meters, the man said.
Jake surveyed the scene.
"See that clump of bushes about 30 yards from the stern of the boat?"
"Got it."
"Pick up the briefcase and get over there. Assemble the rifle and silencer inside and put a round into the boat."
"Where into the boat?"
"Below the waterline," Jake said, "and near the stern. Don't hit anybody."
The man picked up the briefcase and hurried from the restaurant.
"You want to sink them?"
Zelda asked.
"Humiliation is almost as good as a gunshot wound," Jake said.
5 minutes passed, and Jake saw the bushes move. Another 2 minutes, and he saw a splash near the stern of the boat.
"Stone," Marissa said.
"What?"
"My shoes are getting wet."
"Look around. Do you see any waves breaking over the boat?"
"I'm not kidding."
Stone looked down at the space between them and found that his own shoes were getting wet.
"We seem to have sprung a leak," he said, heading for the dock.
By the time he reached it and got Marissa out of the boat, Stone was ankle-deep in lake water. With the help of the dockmaster, he wrestled the boat onto the pontoon and tipped it over enough to empty out most of the water.
"Are all your boats this leaky?" Stone asked the man.
"None of them until now. They've all been recently refurbished."
Stone inspected the little hole in the stern. Then the sun glinted on copper. He reached into the boat and came back with a jacketed slug.
"What's that?"
the dockmaster asked.
"Something that fell out of my pocket,"
Stone replied, looking carefully around for opposition, but seeing none.
"Shall we get another boat?" Marissa asked.
"Let's go home and get some dry shoes," he said.
19. Stone and Marissa went upstairs to change, and he dumped his trousers, damp to the calf, into a hamper, along with his sweaty shirt and underwear, and put trees into his wet shoes. At least they had grown up wet, being alligator. The phone rang, and he sat on the bedside and answered it. "Hello? It's Ed Rawls. How you doing?" "I'm not sure," Stone replied. "That sounds ominous. I was on the boat lake in Central Park after lunch, and somebody put a round through the stern of my rowboat. I found a 23 slug in the bottom of the boat after we hauled it in." "Just sitting there? Not in your leg?" "I figure it must have been fired into the water at the stern, and that took a lot of muzzle velocity off it. Otherwise, it might have hit one of us." "So you were rowing a lady around Central Park Boat Lake? That doesn't sound like you."
"It doesn't feel like me either," Stone said, "but I was cajoled into it with the promise of better things."
Rawls chuckled. "Better collect before she forgets."
"In the meantime, I've had a shot across my bows, even if it was into the stern."
"They're not going to go on warning you forever," Ed said. "Maybe it's time you made a move."
"Maybe so. You got any suggestions?"
"Well, my source tells me that Marker is spending a few days on St. Clair's yacht up here," Rawls said. "I've seen the chopper going back and forth from Rockland."
"You don't have a rocket-propelled grenade launcher handy, do you?"
"Well, no, but I could probably find you one pretty quick. But that might be more of a statement than you want to make at this point in the game."
"I guess so."
"I wouldn't rule it out for later, though," Rawls said. "If they hurt somebody. In the meantime, there might be another alternative."
"Tell me."
Rawls told him.
"I like it," Stone said.
"It's better than tit for tat, but it doesn't escalate things to the point where he'll have to respond with something life-threatening."
"I'll take care of it, then," Rawls said, and the two men hung up.
Marissa had sat down next to him, equally naked. "I seem to recall promising you better things in return for the boat ride."
She pushed him back onto the bed.
"Do with me as you will," Stone said. And she did. Eric Macher and his guests were just finishing their second bottle of wine with their lunch when the captain came and motioned for Macher to leave the table.
"What is it?" Macher asked. "We're having lunch."
"I'm sorry, sir, but the Coast Guard has just hailed us, and they're coming aboard for an inspection."
"What kind of inspection?" Macher demanded. He didn't know anything about boats or the Coast Guard.
"It will be a routine equipment inspection," the captain said. "They'll want to see everything on the required emergency equipment list, life rafts, vests, flares, that sort of thing."
"Is there any reason why that should disturb our lunch?"
"I just wanted you to be aware of their presence," the captain said. "They're coming aboard now from a rigid inflatable. Please, excuse me."
He went to receive the boarding party. A moment later, a young woman in uniform appeared in the dining room.
"Good afternoon," she said. "I'm Lieutenant Graves of the United States Coast Guard. We've come aboard to conduct an investigation."
"An investigation?" Marker said. "I thought this was an equipment check."
"That, too," she replied. "Now, I'll need the names, addresses, dates of birth, and social security numbers of everyone aboard, crew and guests, and I'll need photo IDs for everyone. Please fill out these forms individually." She distributed documents and pens.
"We're in the middle of lunch," Marker said, outraged.
"Not anymore," she replied. "Please bring the completed forms one at a time to the after deck. In the meantime, members of my crew will be conducting a search below decks for contraband."
"Contraband? What sort of contraband?"
"We'll know it when we see it," she said. "Now please fill out the forms, then come to the after deck one at a time."
"I'm terribly sorry about this," Marker said to his guests. "But I suppose we'll have to permit it."
Everyone began filling out the forms. Mocker brought up the rear of the procession to the afterdeck and handed the lieutenant his completed form. The yacht's captain was there, watching as she inspected the yacht's paperwork. "Mr. Mocker, you're the owner here?"
"The owner, as you will have seen in our registration documents, is a Delaware corporation," he replied stiffly.
"Do you represent the owner?"
"I am the president and chief executive officer of St. Clair Enterprises, which owns all of the stock in the corporation."
"Then you are the owner, for the purposes of our investigation."
"I suppose so."
"Who, may I ask, occupies the large cabin and sitting room forward in the yacht?"
"That is the owner's cabin, and I and my companion occupy it."
"Then," she said, holding up a zippered plastic bag, half filled with a white powder, "this belongs to you?"
"It does not," Mocker said. "What is it?"
"I suspect it of being cocaine. I would think that there was more in the bag recently."
"I have never seen that before."
"Who occupied the cabin before you?"
"That would be Mr. Christian St. Clair, who is deceased. This is the first time I have been aboard the yacht, and I did not bring that powder, whatever it is, aboard."
"Were you personally acquainted with Mr. St. Clair?"
"I was. I was his principal colleague in the company."
"And did you know him well enough to suspect that he was an abuser of illegal substances?"
"We were not close personally," Mocker replied.
"Very well, Mr. Mocker. We will confiscate the powder and have it analyzed." She consulted his form. "This is your correct business and personal address?"
"It is."
"Then we will be in touch following the completion of the lab work. In the meantime, you may wish to consult an attorney with maritime experience."
"I shall certainly do so," Mocker replied.
The coast guardsmen and their captain returned to their vessel and departed the yacht, and Mocker was left to explain to his guests why they had been disturbed. He was so furious, he forgot about his planned afternoon tryst.
20.
Jake Herman stood at a loose parade rest before Eric Mocker's desk in Christian St. Clair's old library. He noticed that Mocker seemed to have acquired a slight facial tic, the sudden lifting of his left eyebrow for no apparent reason.
"Good morning, sir," Jake said.
"Not so," Mocker replied. "I have just had a long weekend of cruising aboard my yacht, interrupted by a visit from the Coast Guard."
"Ah, yes, that happens, sir. They like to check to see if a boat has all the required emergency equipment."
"This was something more than that," Mocker replied. "They did an investigatory search of the yacht, going through the guest cabins and the owner's cabin."
"Did they find anything of consequence?"
"They came up with a plastic bag containing a white powder."
"Uh-oh."
"It wasn't my white powder," Mocker yelled, losing it for a moment, then regaining control of himself.
"Of course not, sir. St. Clair must have left it there."
"Most probably, sir.
Were there any consequences of this discovery?"
"A stern lecture from the captain of the Coast Guard vessel. A woman, for God's sake. She's having it tested in their laboratory. Said she'd get back to me."
"I don't believe the Coast Guard has a laboratory, sir, so it probably went to the FBI lab for analysis. Have you taken any defensive steps?"
"The woman advised me to hire an attorney with maritime experience."
"That's probably good advice.
I have a call in to Tommy Berenson, our corporate counsel."
"A good move."
"What happens if the powder is cocaine?" Mocker demanded.
"Well, conceivably, charges for possession could be brought. Or, if there is a substantial quantity, a charge for intent to sell might be added." "It was the first time I'd ever set foot on the yacht. I hadn't even unpacked my bags."
In that case, a good attorney might be able to persuade them not to bring charges, since it was clearly left there by a previous occupant. One now deceased, I might add, and that should stand in your stead.
Jake, I smell a rat here.
One named Stone Barrington. Do you think he might have been able to instigate these events?
Well, sir, anyone could call the Coast Guard and report that a yacht carrying drugs is sailing in Penobscot Bay, and the Coast Guard would be obliged to investigate such a report.
Even if the report were anonymous? I can't imagine Barrington giving them his name.
Yes, sir, even an anonymous report. Of course, any person making such a report that was false and malicious would be subject to arrest for making a false report.
Aha! However, if the substance found aboard turns out to be cocaine or heroin or some other illegal drug, the report would not have been false. In some circumstances, he might even be financially rewarded if the drugs were of sufficient value.
Maka made a groaning noise.
Sir, I would suggest that this incident is unlikely to result in a prosecution because of insufficient evidence. I think the best thing would be to consult your attorney to see if any legal moves were indicated, then to just be patient and wait for the lab to issue its report.
I am a little short of patience, Maka said.
Sir, I originally came in to report on yesterday's incident in Central Park.
Oh, yes, I had forgotten. What happened?
We found Barrington and the Carlson woman in a rowboat on Central Park Lake. One of my men, very carefully, fired a silenced round into the boat, causing it to spring a serious leak.
Heh-heh, Mocker said.
Barrington managed to get the boat to the dock before it could sink, but he was seen to recover the spent round from it, so he knows that he has received a warning.
Now that's what I like to hear,
Mocker said, brightening visibly.
Now he knows where we stand.
Sir, this event took place early Saturday afternoon. When did your brush with the Coast Guard happen?
Late Saturday afternoon.
So that event could have been in response to the earlier one.
Mocker pondered that. I see what you mean, he said. So the ball could be back in our court.
Possibly, sir.
Then we need to respond more forcibly.
If I may suggest, sir, it might be prudent to wait to hear from the Coast Guard before proceeding.
Oh, yes, Mocker said, sounding disappointed.
I could do some pre-planning for a response and get back to you,
Jake said. Yes. Good, Jake. You do that.
Please let me know about the lab report from the Coast Guard, Jake said. It could affect our planning.
Yes, of course, I'll do that.
Jake left Mocker as he had found him, including the eyebrow twitch, which was still there.
Mocker got Tommy Berenson on the phone.
Good day, Eric, the attorney said.
Good day.
I may require some legal advice from an attorney with a knowledge of maritime law.
Shoot.
Mocker gave him an account of the stopping of the yacht and the subsequent search and powder found.
First of all, Eric, I must ask you, and your reply is covered under attorney-client confidentiality, was this powder yours, and is it cocaine?
Tommy, I have just explained to you the exact circumstances.
Yes, but in this case, I need to know if we are up against an actual violation of the law or just some awful coincidence.
Do not make me recount the events. What I have told you is the truth.
Then it is not cocaine?
I have no idea. It wasn't mine.
Then it is not your cocaine.
Tommy,
Mocker said, and his voice was a little shaky,
if I have to explain this to you again, I am going to do so with my hands around your throat. I think it's best to wait for the lab report, then discuss how to proceed from there.
Mocker slammed down the phone with a whimper. 21. Charles Fox listened to the recording from the tiny bug he had placed in Mocker's office and smiled. The man sounded as if he were coming unglued, and that was exactly what Fox wished to happen. He knew that a board meeting had been called for later that morning, and he would record that as well. Mocker rose as the board members filed into his office and took their seats at the conference table. He sat down opposite them.
"Good morning, gentlemen. What is the purpose of this meeting?"
"The purpose," the chairman said dryly, "is to discuss the failure of the takeover bid for the Carlson Clinic."
"Are you implying that this is my failure?"
Mocker asked.
"Eric, you are the CEO. The buck stops with you. May I remind you that Christian St. Clair initiated the takeover bid, presumably with the agreement of this board, and that Christian made a bid that can only be described as lowball, thus starting a bidding war."
"While both of those things are nominally true," the chairman said, "they are irrelevant. We are discussing your actions."
"I took no actions," Eric said.
"Exactly. And there are times when no action is an affirmative action.
Because of the lowball nature of Christian's bid, my only option was to offer a price higher than I deemed the clinic to be worth,"
Mocker said through gritted teeth.
"I am not in the business of paying more than a thing is worth. Had we offered the 150% to begin with, we would now control the Carlson Clinic. You may complain to the ghost of Christian St. Clair about that."
"Also," the chairman said, "it has come to the attention of the board that you are now a suspect in the smuggling of a large quantity of cocaine aboard the company yacht." Mocker shot a glance at Tommy Berenson, whose gaze was now directed at a point at the approximate height of the room's crown molding.
"I want you all to listen to me very carefully," Mocker said, and he gave them an account of the incident aboard the yacht. "I hope that is perfectly clear, because I am not going to explain it to you again."
"So," said the chairman, "as I understand it, we will not know for some time whether these charges are true."
"There are no charges extant," Mocker said.
"I must tell you frankly, Eric, that if these charges are substantiated, we will be required to demand your resignation with immediate effect."
"What charges?"
"Surely you have heard everything I have said," the chairman said.
"Of course, but apparently you have heard nothing I have said. Let me put it this way. There are two possible outcomes to this investigation.
First, that the substance found is not cocaine, in which case no charges will be filed. Second, that the substance is cocaine, in which case the culprit will be seen to be Christian St. Clair, who will not appear to speak in his defense."
"So you say."
"So I say. Is there anything else to discuss?"
"Not at this moment."
"Good. This meeting is adjourned. Tommy, you remain."
The men filed out, and Berenson remained. A thin film of perspiration had appeared on his upper lip.
"Eric, I have not violated your confidence," Berenson said. "Then how did news of the incident aboard the yacht come to the board's attention?"
"I don't know. I didn't know it would be brought up."
"Tommy, if you are lying to me, you will pay dearly."
"I swear to you, I had no knowledge of this, and I have spoken to no one about our conversation."
"Very well. I will take your word for it. You may go."
Berenson went, and quickly. In his office, Charles Fox listened with considerable amusement. When the recording had finished, he took out a cell phone and called Ed Rawls.
"Hey, Charlie, what's going on around there?"
"In a word, Ed, pandemonium."
"I'm happy to hear it."
"Is this the result of our collaboration on the Coast Guard event?"
"It is, certainly.
Mocker, if he wasn't paranoid before, is now climbing the walls
and it would not surprise me if that has the effect of a more serious attempt on the Carlsons, or Barrington, or all of them.
Well, we knew that would have to happen before we achieve a resolution of this sorry affair, didn't we?
I suppose we did.
And we will achieve a satisfactory resolution, Rawls said.
I hope so.
I think the time has come for you to meet Stone Barrington.
I'd like that very much, Fox replied.
Call him at this number in half an hour, Rawls said, dictating it.
22. Joan buzzed Stone. Ed Rawls on one?
Stone picked up.
Yes, Ed? Stone, I think it's time for you to meet my source at St. Clair.
I'm up for that.
His name is Charles Fox, Charlie, to his friends. He's going to call you in half an hour, and I suggest that you invite him to your home for dinner, rather than meet at a restaurant, and warn him not to be followed.
All right. Tell me something about him.
He's in his mid-30s, a southerner, scholarship to Yale, Rhodes Scholar, recruited to the agency by a Yale professor.
I've read his personnel file, and he got high marks from everyone during his training. When I was station chief in Stockholm, he was sent to me for an operation requiring an officer who was not connected to the embassy. He performed beautifully. He'll tell you the rest, including what he wants.
All right. I'll look forward to hearing from him. By the way, I didn't thank you properly for dinner and the guest room. We had a wonderful time.
See ya.
Rawls hung up. Half an hour later, Joan buzzed.
A man who won't give his name, but says you're expecting his call.
Right. Stone pressed the button. Hello?
This is Ed's friend. May we meet?
Are you free for dinner this evening?
Yes.
Stone gave him the address. Come here at 7 and we'll dine in. Ed says you should be careful of a tail.
Right. See you then.
He hung up.
At 7 on the dot, Stone picked up the phone to answer the front door.
Yes? It's Fox.
Stone pressed the button to unlock.
Come in.
He got up and walked from his study into the living room to greet his guest. Charles Fox was about 5'10" and thickly built, maybe 200 pounds. Sandy hair, pleasant mien. He moved like a man who knew how to take care of himself. Stone offered his hand.
I'm Stone.
Fox shook it.
I'm Charlie.
Come into the study, Stone said, leading him in. What will you drink?
I'm a southerner, a bourbon man.
Stone poured 2 Knob Creeks and showed him to one of a pair of chairs before the fireplace, where a small fire blazed.
Ed speaks highly of you, Stone said.
I think highly of him. I thought he got a raw deal at the agency, and I'm glad it got straightened out.
Tell me a little about yourself. The 60-second bio will do.
Born Delano, Georgia, 34 years ago. Father and mother, mill hands. Public schools. Scholarship to Yale to study English lit. A Rhodes. Spent at Oxford. Then back at Yale. Recruited for the agency.
Stone nodded. Did you like it there?
I did. I actually enjoyed the training, especially the physical stuff, which a lot of my classmates shied from. I got a couple of interesting assignments right away, including one in Stockholm under Rawls. I spent 2 years in the London station.
Who'd you work for in London?
Dick Stone.
Ed says you were related.
First cousins.
A good man. He would have been director by now.
Why'd you leave the agency?
I was always a poor boy, and I wanted to make some money. A friend of a friend introduced me to somebody at Goldman Sachs, and they hired me as a trainee. I spent 6 years there, made partner after 5.
How'd you get to St. Clair?
He called me out of the blue, said a friend had suggested he talk to me. I'd heard of the man, of course, so I met him.
He invited me up for a few days on his new yacht, and we got along. He gave me to understand that he needed somebody to work acquisitions, and that he wanted somebody who could rise to CEO quickly. He was backing a guy named Knott to run against Catherine Lee for president, and he told me that when his man was elected, when, not if, mind you, he'd be spending a lot of time in D.C., and if I worked out, I'd be minding the store in New York. I liked the idea. I found Goldman too regimented for me. Too many committees, layers. He offered me $2 million a year with a $1 million signing bonus, and I jumped at it.
I should think you would have, Stone said.
I got there about a month before he blew himself up by opening what sounded like an agency strong case the wrong way.
What did you think of St. Clair?
He was a charmer, but I quickly learned that he liked cutting a corner or two, and I was uncomfortable with that. There was no management tree to speak of, so when he died, the place was adrift. Eric Macher stepped into the breach.
And what did you think of that?
I stayed out of his way until I could figure out what was going to happen. Macher didn't even know who I was. He was based in a security company in D.C. that was St. Clair's personal police force. He's no businessman, and I figured that if I could edge him aside, I might still end up running the place. I checked up on his time at the agency, and it was clear that the man was a thug. I figured that if I stuck around St. Clair and had to work for Macher, I'd end up in jail. I started collecting information that might stand me in good stead if the FBI or the New York Attorney General's office came calling. There was a lot of gossip around the office, and I made notes. Then I got into the company's most secure computer network. I've copied a huge lot of documents, more than enough to cover me.
What do you plan to do with it?
I don't have a plan yet. I just want to get out of there before the place blows. Macher is a deeply paranoid character who reacts badly when he's crossed. He's in league with a lawyer named Thomas Berenson, who's corporate counsel, and during my computer searches I came up with a will for Christian St. Clair that Berenson had drawn, that pretty much handed the company to Macher. I also came up with the original will. Berenson had just substituted the new stuff for a couple of pages of the original, which had already been executed, and which didn't mention Macher at all.
That was pretty slick of Macher.
He's a dangerous guy in more ways than one. He had a reputation at the agency for unnecessary violence. He's got a guy named Jake Herman, ex-FBI, who left the Bureau under unfavorable circumstances, and he's doing for Macher what Macher used to do for St. Clair, except out of the New York office instead of D.C. The two of them make quite a pair. Stone set down his drink.
Will you excuse me for a moment? I want to make a phone call.
Sure. Stone got up and called Mike Freeman. I'm dining with an interesting young man that you should meet. Can you join us at my house?
What time?
Now is good. We're still on drinks.
I'll be there in 15 minutes.
Stone hung up and rang Fred, letting him know they'd be three for dinner. 23. Mike Freeman arrived and was given a drink while Stone and Charlie started a new one. Stone introduced Mike to Charlie and filled him in on his background with Charlie's help. Dinner was served and Fred poured the wine.
"So, Charlie," Stone said, "what do you want to do as soon as you can extricate yourself from Macher and St. Clair?"
"Well, if I can't run St. Clair, I'd like to go into the mergers and acquisitions business for myself, or with partners." Stone and Mike exchanged a glance.
"What sort of acquisitions interest you?" Stone asked.
"Startups or interesting small companies with the potential for rapid growth if they get the financing they need."
"What are you prepared to invest in such a business?" Mike asked.
$5 million to start.
I made a couple of really good deals at Goldman, and I've still got my starting bonus from St. Clair.
Is that everything you've got? Mike asked.
Not quite, and I'd need a salary to live on, of course.
Where do you live? Stone asked.
I have a suite at the Lombardy Hotel on East 56th Street. It's expensive, but I get hotel services like room service, laundry, and maid, so I don't have to spend any time keeping house.
How much time were you putting in on a weekly basis at Goldman? Mike asked.
60 to 80 hours a week, Charlie replied. It was what was expected of the younger guys, and it was too much. I want a life, too.
That seems reasonable.
They chatted on through dinner, and Stone got the strong impression that Mike wanted to go into business with Charlie Fox. After dessert, he pulled Mike aside.
What do you think? I think we need this guy, Mike said. We've been acquiring slowly, catch as catch can, and we need somebody who can put together deals and do the due diligence. I think you're right, and I think he's the guy. I've got some free office space in our building. We can install him there with a secretary and a small staff.
Good, Stone replied.
What should we pay him? $1 million a year. Then bump him up to 2 as soon as he starts doing deals that will support it. I reckon we're going to be pumping in operating expenses for at least a year, but that's what we're for in the deal, the daddies.
Are you going to kick in free rent?
Sure, until he generates the revenue to pay for it.
They went back to the dinner table.
I guess you've got a contract with St. Clair, Stone said.
Charlie produced it from an inside pocket.
Christian drew it up and I signed it.
Stone read it quickly.
Nothing to keep you from taking a hike whenever you feel like it. Or to keep him from firing me out of hand.
Can you just walk out tomorrow?
I need a little more time with document collection, Charlie said. Then I'm out.
He paused.
If I've got some place to go.
Mike and I want to give you that place, Stone said.
He outlined the deal he and Mike had discussed.
What do you think?
Do I get a piece of each deal?
You can invest up to 1/3 of each one, if you can find the money.
Charlie shook his head.
I want a fee for each deal, and that gets plowed in as an investment.
What sort of a fee?
1/3 of 1/3 of the investment. Sometimes I'll be able to ante up, sometimes not.
Stone and Mike exchanged a nod.
That's a very sweet deal, Charlie, Stone said, offering his hand. You'd better hold up your end.
Agreed, Charlie said, and he shook Mike's hand, too. When I said I was in